Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you all for coming. We have a full capacity crowd for our guest today, but first, as always, a couple of housekeeping notes. First of all, everybody please at least mute and preferably turn off your cell phones. If everybody pulls them out at the same time, nobody should be shy about doing it. And please take a look, make sure it's muted or preferably turned off. That's particularly good since we've got a number of television cameras here. We don't want noise in the middle of Mr. Bolton's remarks. Second of all, I'd like to tell you about two upcoming events that we have. On Wednesday of next week, we have Malu Mangahas. She is the executive director of the Philippine Center for Investigative Journalism. She's speaking on a very sad and important issue, which is the number of murders of journalists in the Philippines. It has now become the world's second deadliest place to work as a journalist, trailing only Iraq. So I hope as many of you as possible will sign up for that on your way out. That one is not yet full. Next, we have a prominent businessman whom many of you may know coming to speak to us on the 20th. That's a Tuesday. And that is David Eldon. Many of you probably know him. He was the chairman of HSBC Asia, spent much of his career in Hong Kong, although he was also in Malaysia and the Middle East. And he'll be giving his perspectives and insights into what's going on in the current financial crisis. With that, I'd like to introduce Mr. John Bolton. He was the Undersecretary of State for Arms Control from 2001 to 2005. He was the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, 2005-2006. He's also a well-known lawyer, having worked at Covington & Burling and now at Kirkland & Ellis, and he's also a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. With that, I'd like to give you Mr. Bolton. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and thank all of you for coming today. This is obviously the time in the U.S. political cycle as we approach Inauguration Day when everybody is looking backward and forward, saying what happened during the Bush administration, what can we expect from the Obama administration. So I'd be happy to answer questions on either of those subjects, but just as I open, I'd just like to focus on looking back at the Bush administration. In answer to the question, where do you think history will place the Bush administration, I try always to refuse to answer, because I think it's a fool's errand to predict what historians are going to say next month or 50 years from now or 100 years from now. But I think you can look back and ask, what was it that the administration did right in our current context, and what did they do wrong? And I'm obviously going to focus on the foreign policy, national security area. I think the most important thing about the Bush administration was the president's response to 9/11. It was the single most important event of his administration, or I think the single most important event since the collapse of communism. And I think the both the personal leadership that he displayed and the international leadership he displayed was very important for the United States, and the policies that he put in place let's be clear, have prevented another such terrorist attack on American soil since then. That was the principal mission that he gave himself. He felt that he on his watch, America had been attacked, and he was determined not to let it happen again. And with less than 2 weeks to go, he has succeeded in that mission. Whether that record will continue going forward, I think, is very much up in the air, because I think that the war paradigm that Bush put in place to deal with international terrorism was a dramatic change from the law enforcement paradigm that had been in place in the Clinton administration and before, and perhaps from the return of the law enforcement paradigm that we might be about to see. Now, in specific response to 9/11, Bush ordered the military action in Afghanistan that overthrew the Taliban and that confined al-Qaeda to a very narrow band of territory on the border with Pakistan. That seems to me to be an unequivocal success. It's certainly true that that Afghanistan today does not represent a model of efficient central government, which means it's pretty much like every other Afghan government in the past 500 or 600 years. But the removal of the Taliban, the removal of that safe haven, was an incredibly important event. And I believe that the second decision, the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, was a significant step in strategic protection for the United States and the world as a whole, removing from power somebody who was a continuing threat to peace and security in the Middle East and indeed the world as a whole, somebody who had used weapons of mass destruction against neighboring countries and against his own people, and that who undoubtedly, once free of UN sanctions and UN weapons inspectors, would have reestablished his WMD capabilities. One small fact that doesn't get a lot of attention is that during all of the years after the first Persian Gulf War, Saddam Hussein kept together a cadre of about 1,000 nuclear scientists and technicians. He used to call them his nuclear mujahideen. These were the people with the intellectual capability to recreate the nuclear weapons program. So while it's true that roving bands of UN inspectors couldn't find operating centrifuges, the fact was that Saddam had retained the ability to recreate that program at a moment of his choosing. Not only did we eliminate the threat that Saddam posed, but we had the important collateral benefit that Muammar Gaddafi concluded that he might be next, an erroneous conclusion, but a very important one, because looking out for number one, he decided that he would rather remain in power, even if it meant giving up his nuclear weapons program. And indeed, the decision by Libya to give way on that was a further important step in helping us unravel the AQ Khan network, because while we used it in the first instance to open up the possibility with Libya, Libya also gave us significant information that we used down the road. Now, obviously, in the years after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the situation in Iraq deteriorated to a very significant degree. And that led many people, not least of whom was the majority leader of the Senate, Harry Reid, to say the war in Iraq is lost. This is, in my view, a generational phenomenon that baby boomers and others of that ilk have based on Vietnam. Once a war starts going badly, it inevitably leads to complete failure. We've seen in Iraq with the surge policy that that inevitability is not, in fact, the case. I don't know how Iraq will turn out, but I think the Iraqis now do have an opportunity to decide if they want one country or three, and we have helped produce that. What happened between the overthrow of Saddam and the launch of the surge policy, which I think every close observer appreciates was something that came from Bush himself, what happened in the meantime, in the interim, was the interplay of personalities and agencies in the administration that also characterized a great many other foreign policy decisions, and that I think revealed one of the administration's greatest weaknesses. There's been all kinds of criticism about the post-Saddam policies in Iraq. People said we didn't have plans for what to do after the overthrow, that we didn't follow through on them. In fact, we had lots of plans. The problem was we had too many plans, and no one of which was ever selected crisply and implemented cleanly. And that reflected, I think, an inability in the national security decision-making progress to make decisions and to get a clear direction from the president. I think that's largely due to the national security advisor at the time and the policies that she pursued, a constant searching for bureaucratic compromise rather than identifying differences and serving them up to the president for decision making. But obviously the buck stops in the Oval Office, not on Condi Rice's desk, and the fact that we had muddled decision making and too much delegation to below the president's level ultimately has to be laid at the feet of the president himself. And I think that really does explain the difference between success in the initial military operation against Saddam Hussein, success in the surge operation, inconclusive and negative results for all of the years in between. That inability to come to sharp decisions and to follow through on those decisions for a sustained period also characterized, unfortunately, the president's policies with respect to nuclear proliferation, dealing particularly with North Korea and Iran. The administration is criticized for, in the first term in particular, pursuing a very hard line against North Korea and Iran. And my response to that is, if only we did not pursue a hard line, we pursued a very wavering line that allowed, in the case of North Korea, that their continued work on their nuclear program up to and including a test of a nuclear device in October of 2006 and a strengthening or at least a persistence of Kim Jong-il's regime that continues to this day. And in the case of Iran, you have an example of what happens when you rely on diplomacy. And I think this is a very important example of the controversy that we hear so much about the proper role of diplomacy in resolving significant international challenges like this. Now, the popular idea of this conflict is, on the one hand, you have a bunch of very reasonable people who say things like, you need to engage, and who say things like, you have to talk to your adversaries as well as your friends, on the one hand, versus a bunch of people like me who are essentially unilateralist cowboys who don't like talking to anybody. That's not the debate. The debate is between two positions that go roughly as follows. One position believes that diplomacy is the answer to resolve international problems in about 99 in 44 one-hundredths percent of the cases. You remember the old Ivory Snow commercial about 99 in 44 one-hundredths percent pure? That's one position. That happens to be my position. That position stands in contrast to the view that diplomacy is the solution in 100% of the cases. That's the position that has the obsession and the misperception about what diplomacy can accomplish. And Iran illustrates this very clearly. The Iranians have been engaged in discussions with the Europeans for well over 5 years now, during which time the Iranians and the Europeans understood that Europe was speaking for the United States in offering Iran the possibility not only of a normal relationship with them, but with Washington as well. And in the language of diplomacy of carrots and the sticks, the Europeans, masters of the art of carrot making, offered the Iranians every carrot their little hearts could think of to induce the Iranians to give up their nuclear weapons program. And the net of 5 years plus of European diplomacy is that Iran today is five plus years closer to a nuclear weapons capability. The Bush administration thus criticized on Iran and on North Korea for this so-called hard line approach, in fact, wasn't able to pursue a consistent policy until we got to the second term, when Condi Rice moved to the State Department and became Secretary of State and adopted, in my view, the approach to being Secretary that her predecessor, Colin Powell, had followed. Briefly stated, there are two models for a Secretary of State. One is the Jim Baker model. When he came to state in Bush 41's administration, he said, I am the president's envoy to the State Department, not the other way around. And that's the way he ran the State Department during his tenure. Powell's model was he was the State Department's envoy to the White House. And in the first term, that caused him a great deal of trouble. When Condi Rice came to the State Department, I predicted personally she would follow the Baker model. And I turned out to be completely wrong, because in a very short period of time, she had absorbed the State Department culture and was its megaphone inside the administration. In short, the opposite of the Baker model. But because she had the president's ear because of his trust and reliance on her, her policies have prevailed throughout. So on issues like Iran and North Korea, I think you will all be surprised when the president-elect is inaugurated to find that the policies on those two issues and on many others, probably including the Middle East, are not going to be that different than the policies of the second term of the Bush administration. Now, I'm saddened by that. I didn't agree with it when Bush was doing it, and I can promise you I won't agree with it when Obama does it. But the notion that there will be substantial shifts on some of these critical issues, I think, mistakes what has happened in the second Bush term. Now, there are a range of obviously very important issues that go beyond what I've been able to talk about in this brief period of time: how to deal with a resurgent Russia, what to do about China, what direction China may take, how to handle the increased level of tension on the subcontinent between Pakistan and India, when Fidel Castro will finally die, and other other issues like that. And I'd be delighted to try and turn to that in the question period. But to conclude on the Bush administration, I think that that history will say that on the key issue, that is to say the American response to terrorism, he certainly got it right at the beginning, and his steadfastness was important in preventing subsequent attacks on America, but that he was not able to follow through on collateral issues like the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction in a systematic and sustained way. And the result is, therefore, at the end of the 8 years, while we are stronger in some respects, we are weaker and more vulnerable in others. And that's why his record in history will be mixed. Thank you very much. So I think I'm going to come back over here and sit down and drink my coffee and answer questions. Is that right?
Okay.
Okay, who would like to ask the first question? Right here in the front, please.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. My name is Paul Curley. I'm interested in your views on Cuba. Do you think that the Cuban embargo has been an effective policy, and do you think the Obama administration is going to change it?
I think it has been effective for the purpose that we wanted to over a long period of trying to reduce Castro's influence in the region as a whole. I think that the great tragedy is that the Bay of Pigs failed and we didn't overthrow him in the early 1960s. I think the fact now is that everybody's waiting for him to die, and that there will be major changes in Cuba after that happens. He is the only figure who remains who can rally any kind of support for that regime, and I think when he finally shuffles off this mortal coil, it will disintegrate very rapidly.
Why can't his brother keep things together? His brother's getting more and more visibility. He has a few years possibly to establish himself. Yeah. He's already had a couple.
I think it'll be like East Germany when the wall fell. Remember great East German leaders like Egon Krenz and so on, these apparatchiks who took over temporarily. I think in the Cuban case, though, it'll pop like a balloon.
Okay. Back here, please.
Mark Michelson, Ambassador Bolton, you mentioned about a resurgent Russia. We now have a very serious world economic crisis, which has adversely affected Russia, Iran,
Thank God.
Venezuela. I know, but
what a list.
Do you think? Yeah, Do you think this presents opportunities for the new administration? Obviously, you don't seem very confident they'll take advantage of it, but be interested to see if you think it does and what sort of policies it should follow, again, in light of what's going on.
Well, I buy the notion that Obama fundamentally doesn't want to be bothered by foreign policy. I think he wants to focus on the domestic economic recovery and his other domestic priorities. Now, obviously, he won't be able to do that as much as he wants to, and I think we've already seen in President Medvedev's State of the Nation speech the day after our election, when he threatened to deploy ballistic missiles into the Kaliningrad enclave if we went ahead with missile defense deployment in Poland and the Czech Republic. The attack on Georgia in August of last year, the current suspension of oil and natural gas deliveries from Gazprom and so on, I think are all related, and I think they come back to the point that Putin made when he was still president about 3 or 3.5 years ago, when he said that the breakup of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. I at least thought it was one of the great way to end the 20th century, but that's obviously not the dominant view in Moscow. And it could be that all of these things are connected to an effort by Putin and the Russian leadership not to recreate the territory of the Soviet Union, but to establish Russian hegemony in that space. Now, the fact is that Putin has benefited enormously from high global oil prices, and he's done several things with that inside Russia. He's spread it around. It's one of the sources of his political popularity, and he's used it for strategic modernization and for modernization of Russian conventional capabilities. With that revenue gone for the foreseeable future, he's obviously much more constrained. And even with prices as high as they had been, he had not been able to do in the military field nearly as much as he wanted. There's a little story about the Russians when they came out of Abkhazia. They went into Georgia proper and at one point occupied a base where a few weeks or months before Americans had been training Georgia military units, and we had left behind, I don't know, some jeeps and trucks and stuff like that. And when the Russians, after the Russians seized the base and withdrew, they took the trucks and the jeeps with them because they were so much better than theirs. Now, when an army is doing that, you know that that army's still got significant problems. And that's why I do think that the reduction in oil prices is significant. But even after the price has fallen, the Gazprom threats to Europe and so on are obviously not being done independently of the Kremlin. And so I don't think that the economic constraints that Putin faces change his strategic objectives. They certainly will hamper him in the near term, and I think we ought to try and take advantage of that.
Tom Mitchell.
Ambassador Bolton, President Bush initially seemed inclined to take a strategic competitor approach vis-a-vis China, and that inevitably moderated after 9/11, having to deal with North Korea. Do you think that original instinct was right?
I don't know what the right answer to that question is, because I don't think we know what direction China is going to go in. I think there's one scenario, much beloved by American business people, of the peaceful rise of 20 or 30 years of so far of nearly unimpeded economic growth. And if you extrapolate from the last 20 or 30 years, it looks like unimpeded economic growth and more powerful China on into the future. On the other hand, if you take a slightly longer perspective, like 100 years, this has been a century that started with the fall of the last dynasty, the first Republic of China, the first fall of the Republic of China, the warlord period, the Japanese invasion, the civil war between the communists and the nationalists, the defeat of Japan, the second establishment of the Republic of China, the second fall of the Republic of China, the communist takeover, the Great Leap Forward, the single biggest human disaster in history, 30 million dead caused by economic policy, followed by the Cultural Revolution, the biggest destruction of Chinese culture in history, Tiananmen Square, then followed by 20 years of economic growth. So it depends on what you straight line or project into the future. I mean, one, if you take a longer view, we are in China, let's take a century. A projection of the last century is a century of radical discontinuities. I have no idea which is the better predictor, and I think for the American president, the responsibility should be, in whatever limited way he can, to try and move China in the continued direction of the peaceful rise. But I think we have to be clear our influence is limited and see what happens in China. I would be worried if I couldn't predict with more certainty what the future of China would be. I would be worried, except I don't think the Chinese can predict it any better than we can.
Over in the corner here. Oh, on the veranda. I'm sorry. I couldn't tell which way you were pointing. I'm sorry.
Hi, I'm Tu Hanxi, a reporter from the South China Morning Post, although you can't see me. Mike Chinoy, a former CNN reporter, wrote this book about North Korea where he basically effectively puts the blame on hardliners like Mr. Bolton for escalating the nuclearization of North Korea. Mike Chinoy infers in his book that if officials like Mr. Bolton had not taken such a hard line, North Korea's nuclear program would not have been so advanced. And actually, Condoleezza Rice was much more moderate. What do you say to that, Mr. Bolton?
He's right. You know, I talked to him about that book, and I had a lot of respect. I have a lot of respect for him as a reporter and so on. But I think he has bought the conventional wisdom that North Korea can be talked out of its nuclear weapons program, and I simply don't believe that will happen. I don't think there is anything that we can offer Kim Jong-il that will get him in an honest way to give up his nuclear weapons program. I think he sees the nuclear weapons as a trump card against us, against Japan, against South Korea, really within North Korea itself. I think he is perfectly happy to negotiate about giving up the nuclear weapons program. I think he's perfectly happy to commit to giving up the nuclear weapons program. By my count, he's done it 4 times in the past 16 years. The only problem is when you get to the point of actually giving it up, he can't seem to get over that last little hurdle. And it's because he wants and has achieved the best outcome from his perspective, which is keep the nuclear weapons program and extract tangible economic and political benefits from the U.S., Japan, and South Korea that help prop up the regime, which is obviously his biggest goal. So I think the idea that you can trust the North Koreans when they make a commitment to giving up the nuclear weapons capability is a huge mistake, and I think we've been pursuing that policy for over 5 years. I think it's failed. I think it will continue to fail. I think what we need is greater pressure from China, which is the only country that can really affect North Korea, supplying 80 to 90% of its energy needs. I think China doesn't want North Korea with nuclear weapons any more than the United States does. But I think China is worried that if they apply too much pressure to the regime in the North to get them to give up nuclear weapons, that they'll collapse the regime. And then they'll have a reunified Korean Peninsula, and they don't want that. So in a very understandable human reaction, fearful of applying too much pressure, they don't apply enough pressure at all. And therefore, North Korea keeps its nuclear weapons program, which is not in China's interest any more than it is in ours.
Front here.
My name is Angus Forsyth. Do you think that the emergence of the Chinese Navy into international waters and the announced intention to build an aircraft carrier represents a significant issue for the American control of the high seas?
I think it represents a significant enhancement of Chinese capabilities in the waters near to China, up to and including Taiwan. I don't think it's yet a threat way out into the blue water, although it's obviously a step in that direction. And I think that's one reason why finding greater stability in the cross-straits relationship is going to be important. I would worry, if I were on Taiwan, I would worry that in a China where the People's Liberation Army has a larger political role and that threatens Taiwan in an Obama administration, that they might not get the same reaction that they got during the Clinton administration. So I think this should be a very high priority in the next administration, but whether it will be or not, I don't think you can predict at this point.
Francis.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. As you don't sound very optimistic about the approach or interest that the incoming administration is going to have in foreign policy, I'm wondering where you think its first major blunder might be. And I'm wondering
there's
whether,
so much to choose from.
And to offer you a possibility, I wanted to ask you what you think approach they will take, would take, should not take towards what's happening in Gaza.
Yeah. You know, this is a good example of the difficulty of predicting what the Obama administration will do, since the range of positions that are open to him is so broad, unconstrained by what he has said in the campaign or in his prior 4 years in the U.S. Senate. And he just made a statement the other day wasn't very illuminating on that point, and that actually cuts against the priority I think he has to domestic policy, because he said after January the 20th he's going to be very engaged in it. I think it is always a risk for new administrations that say to themselves, boy, if I could just get in there and talk to these people, I could solve this problem. I have a sense that's what he thinks. And, you know, so it's only been 60 years since the creation of Israel and the problem has been solved, but why not next month?
What should they not do?
I think that they should let Israel finish what it plans to do to Hamas, because I think sometimes in military struggles there ought to be a winner and a loser.
The woman in the back here, please.
Thank you. My name's Rachel Cartland. Is that? Okay, sorry.
We can hear you.
Yeah, good. There's some sort of feedback from outside. Ambassador Bolton, you made a very, seemed to me, a very prescient point in your presentation about the way baby boomers react to Iraq, shadowed by their experience or reaction to what had happened in Vietnam. And I can certainly relate to that, being indeed from that age group. So I'd like to ask you a personal question, if I may. What was your own personal experience of the Vietnam War, and how did that affect your subsequent intellectual development and thinking about things?
Yeah. Well, I felt I was in college in the late 60s. I graduated in 1970, and I felt at that time, after Nixon's election in 1968, that the war might drag on but was essentially lost. And my feeling, as everybody of college age did at that point, was you had to make a decision what you were going to do with respect to the draft. And I joined the Army Reserves and served in the Reserves and the Guard for 6 years. I thought about whether that was the right thing to do, and I thought a lot about it, as kids in college did at that point. And I concluded that my going to Vietnam and dying in a rice paddy that Teddy Kennedy would more than happily have given back to the Viet Cong wasn't a good use of my time. And that's why I joined the reserves. And I don't necessarily think that was the best decision I could have made, but it was a decision I did make. I consulted with my father, who was a D-Day veteran, about it. He thought it was the right decision, and that's what I did. And that was 39 years ago, and it's hard to look back now.
Over here, please.
Suzanne Watkinson, Connect Communication. Let's look ahead, perhaps to the next year or possibly the next 4 years. If John McCain had been elected the next president, what main differences do you see would happen, and particular focus to us here in Asia, over what will happen with Obama running the joint?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, that's a very serious answer. It may not sound like a serious answer, but I don't honestly know. And we'll never find out, so I'm not sure that I have anything to add to the subject.
The gentleman here, please.
My name is Darrell Goldby. Ambassador Bolton, you started off by saying about the Americans going into Afghanistan to get rid of the Taliban and said nothing else after that. But the British lost two wars in Afghanistan. The Russians were defeated. President-elect Obama has said he'll put 20,000 more troops into Afghanistan. Isn't that a lost cause? It's a tribal state. How can you expect the Westerners to go in there and win?
Well, I think the issue for me about Afghanistan and that border with Pakistan is not so much the Taliban as it is al-Qaeda. And the strong view that that many have that whatever is left of the leadership of al-Qaeda is somewhere along that border on one side or the other. In terms of the Taliban itself, while its strength has grown unquestionably since 2001-2002, I think that one of the main reasons for that has been their control over drug cultivation. And I think the one thing we should be doing, not so much related to an increase of 20,000 fighters into Afghanistan, but is eradication of the drug crops. And our military has been unwilling to do that. I don't understand that, frankly. We have both a law enforcement interest because of illicit narcotics internationally, but I think the way that we have experience in dealing with narcotics in a variety of places, and it's the farmers who are growing the narcotic crops are making a sound economic decision. It's much better to grow that than soybeans or something else from an economic point of view. So the only way you change that calculus is to say your price for drugs is going to be zero because there aren't going to be any poppy crops left standing. And until we're willing to do that, I think the Taliban will continue to have an economic base and will continue to be a threat. I don't think it's so much a military question from our point of view as it is eliminating the drugs.
On the veranda.
Don Meyer, a quick question, Ambassador. The someone agrees with you that Saddam Hussein was a bit of a piece of work and there are threats because of his prior weapons, et cetera. However, removing him created something of a vacuum for Iraq, and Iran seems to be the beneficiary of that. And the one argument for letting him stay there is the one piece of work is a countervailing force to the other.
Yeah. Well, look, that was that concern about instability in Iraq was what motivated President Bush 41 not to go on to Baghdad after destroying the Iraqi forces in Kuwait. The trouble, though, was that having failed to follow up on Desert Storm, Saddam returned to the pattern of behavior that he had been engaged in before, and that threat was there, and I don't think it was going to go away. So at some point you were going to have to grasp the nettle and overthrow Saddam. Now, reasonable people can then disagree about what happened next, and I want to come back to that in a second. But the idea that the overthrow of Saddam somehow advantaged Iran substantially more in the region than their efforts would already have given them, I think, is a mistake. Iran has financed Hezbollah and Hamas. They've financed the Taliban in Afghanistan. They've got this continuing nuclear weapons program. The Gulf Arab states were already worried about the rise of Iranian influence. They have essentially achieved hegemony over Syria, a Sunni Arab state. So the long campaign for Iran by Iran for increasing their influence would have happened, whatever happened with Saddam. And the fact was that they were they counterbalanced to some extent. They were both threats for different reasons. And I think you have to make decisions on what is feasible to do. It was feasible to overthrow Saddam, and I think it was the right thing to do. And let me just say, back on the question of what happened after the war, as an illustration of the problems of Bush administration decision-making, I'd urge anybody who's interested to read two books about that. One is Jerry Bremer's book called My Year in Iraq, about what he did, what he was there, what he thought, his marching orders. And then read Doug Feith's book about the decision to overthrow Saddam and what came after that. These are two very thoroughly written books by two very dedicated people, both sincere and honest and hardworking, that represent radically different views as to what they thought our policy was in Iraq post-Saddam's overthrow. And you can't reconcile those two books. You can't imagine how two people in those positions could have had such diametrically opposed views of what our policy was. And it shows why, fundamentally, the policy was incoherent. Had that not occurred, then I think we might be in a very different situation in Iraq than we are now. Although things are improved, had we performed in a more consistent pattern, the debate would look very different than it does today.
Last question from Bonnie. I'm afraid we're running out of time.
Bonnie Engel, Asian Art News, not my usual beat. Ambassador Bolton, I would like to ask you a little bit about the UN. In the light of the Republicans' low esteem and the current administration's low esteem of the United Nations, how did you feel being appointed the ambassador? And when you went there, did you have objectives and did you attain them?
Well, I like to say the UN was a target-rich environment. there's so much wrong with it that on almost any given day you couldn't walk the halls without stumbling into a problem to try and correct. The fact is that the organization suffers from a number of defects that are very, very hard to remedy, and that I don't think augur well for its future. I think much of what we saw in the oil for food scandal permeates the organization as a whole, and I don't think it was ever summed up better than by Paul Volcker, now senior advisor to the Obama presidency, who was appointed by Kofi Annan to investigate the oil for food scandal, and at the end of it came up with a series of reports, not just on oil for food, but on the UN system itself, that that make for devastating reading. He was asked at a hearing in the Senate in 2005 about the report and whether he thought there was a culture of corruption in the UN. And he said, Volcker said, "No, I don't think there's a culture of corruption, but I think there's a culture of inaction." And I couldn't have said it better myself.
With apologies, it's 2 o'clock sharp, and we try to make a point of wrapping up our lunches then, and Mr. Bolton has to go on. But we do welcome all of you. We appreciate your coming, and we hope we'll see many of you either next week for the speaker, the executive director of the Center for Philippine Investigative Journalism, or the following week for Mr. David Eldon. With that, we always like to give our guests a gift to remember the club by. And put it up here for me. Okay.
But I don't get one.
We'll give it to him afterwards.
They're all Democrats.
Thanks very much. Not in its usual place behind me. Great. Here it is. Okay. We didn't forget. Thank you.
We'd like to record this for posterity if we can. You guys can stay there?
Yes. Would you hold the FT?
Yes, what's the headline?
No, it's just another fraud.
Fraud. Fraud in English. Yeah.
So as I take a step to the left.
Okay.
Not I.
Step to the left.
No, seriously.
Seriously. Oh, why?